From South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment News Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from around the state. You can listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or tell that smart speaker, play SDPB. You can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to the Segments Podcast. And now, it's time for your weekly roundup in news coverage. Environmental concerns have kept 4th of July fireworks away from Mount Rushmore for the past 11 years. But now, they're coming back because the state got President Trump's attention. SDPB's Seth Tupper reports.
In January, the president made a grand entrance to the East Room of the White House. He was there to sign a trade deal with China. A crowd of dignitaries was on hand, and Trump took time to recognize some of them, including South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem. When he introduced Noem, Trump launched into a story about teaming up with her, not on trade, but on bringing fireworks back to Mount Rushmore this summer. He said bogus concerns about fires and the environment were the only thing standing in the way.
I said, what can burn? It's stone. You know, it's stone. It's ground. So nobody knew why. They just said environmental reasons. So I called up our people, and within about 15 minutes, we got it approved, and you're going to have your first big fireworks display at Mount Rushmore, and I'll try and get out there if I can, okay?
When Trump said nobody knew why the fireworks ended, he was wrong. Plenty of people knew why. The fireworks were starting fires, spreading litter, and polluting water. Dan Wink is a former superintendent of Mount Rushmore National Memorial. He approved the fireworks when they started in 1998, and he knows why they ended after 2009.
Everybody knows why they were stopped. It was the condition of the forest. There is more than stone. It's in the middle of a national forest. There are things there that can burn. The question is can you mitigate the potential adverse effects?
For Wink, back in 1998, the answer to that question was yes. A $60 million project to improve the buildings and grounds at Mount Rushmore was almost done. A celebration was planned, and somebody suggested fireworks. There hadn't been a fireworks show at Mount Rushmore in 59 years. Wink says his chief ranger tried to talk him out of it.
He came up to me one day, and as a good chief ranger should, and said, should I sit here and tell you all the reasons why we shouldn't do fireworks at Mount Rushmore, or have you made the decision? And, basically at the end of the conversation, I said, I think we're going to do them, Mike. Let's figure out how to do them safely and how to do it effectively, have a great event, do it safely, protect the mountain, protect the forest, and protect the visitors.
Another naysayer was Bill Gabbert. He was the fire management officer for 7 Park Service sites, including Mount Rushmore. He's now retired, and he writes a blog called Wildfire Today. On that blog, he said shooting fireworks in July over the forest around Mount Rushmore is, quote, an insane concept, end quote. But the 1998 show went ahead. About 20,000 people crammed into and around the memorial. Traffic was backed up for miles. A Pennsylvania company, Zambelli Fireworks, put on a spectacular display. By the time the smoke cleared, Wink knew a tradition was born.
The people at Zambelli, who did it, who done fireworks across the country and the world, said it was one of the most patriotic shows they'd ever seen. Just the place and the way it was done. And so there was a lot of interest in doing it again.
Over the next few summers, there were some problems. Glowing embers floated down and started fires in the forest. 60 to 80 firefighters had to be stationed around the mountain for every show. They roamed the rocky terrain, and when they saw a fire, they put it out. None of the fires burned out of control, but they tempted fate. One year, there were about 10 fires. That experience is burned into Wink's memory because the next morning, he got a phone call from his boss in the Park Service.
And he goes, so I hear you had some fires. And I said, yes, we did. His name was Bill. And I just said, Bill, I'm ready to not do these ever again. And he said to me, he said, don't be so fast, do an after action review, figure out what went right, what went wrong, and make a decision, based on all the information.
Wink did the review, but he didn't stop the fireworks. Instead, he developed a set of go, no-go criteria. The criteria relied on factors like moisture levels and weather to estimate the fire risk. Wink left Rushmore for another job at the end of 2001. In 2002, the fireworks show was canceled because of fire danger, but the shows continued after that. Then, in 2010, the show was canceled again. A mountain pine beetle epidemic was killing millions of trees in the Black Hills National Forest. The dead timber was potential fuel for wildfires. The fireworks were too risky. Around that same time, the Park Service was using a pesticide to protect trees at Mount Rushmore from the beetles. They wanted to make sure the pesticide wasn't getting in the water, so they asked the U.S. Geological Survey to do a study. Galen Hogestrat worked on the study. He didn't find any pesticide in the water, but he did find a chemical compound called perchlorate.
It's not really a common thing to occur naturally, especially in our geology. So just the presence of it at any concentration here in the Black Hills is somewhat of a head scratcher to think about, well, how did it get there?
The only possible culprit was the fireworks. When the water study was published in 2016, there was no official EPA limit on perchlorate in drinking water, but the interim benchmark was 15 micrograms per liter. A median level of 23 was found in a Mount Rushmore well. That was concerning, but Hogestrat says it wasn't an emergency.
It's more of a risk to the people if somebody were to be drinking that water year-round. If somebody's only filling up a 1 liter water bottle once a summer, it's not much of a risk.
Besides the water pollution, there's also a litter problem. Cheryl Schreier was the superintendent of Rushmore from 2010 until she retired last year. She says paper and other debris from the exploded fireworks shells is a chronic problem.
I'll be honest, it's no secret. There's firework debris that is still being picked up from 2009.
For Schreier and her bosses in the Park Service, after the fires, the water pollution, and the litter, enough was enough. They held off on fireworks every year after 2009 and eventually reached a consensus.
Fireworks were not going to be a part of Mount Rushmore any further.
That didn't sit well with people in South Dakota's tourism industry. Footage of the fireworks at Mount Rushmore was aired all over the world every 4th of July. It was free advertising and they wanted it back. Enter South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem. After she took office in 2018, she went to a White House meeting with other governors. They all told the president what they were working on. Noem talked about tax reform and trade agreements.
And then off the cuff at the end said, you know, we lost our fireworks years ago at Mount Rushmore, so if you could help us get those back, that'd be great.
That got Trump's attention.
And he, ever since then, has kind of, taken the bull by the horns.
In May, Noem announced that the state and federal government had an agreement. They were going to work together on bringing fireworks back to Mount Rushmore this summer. Federal law requires an environmental assessment before that can happen. That assessment is underway now. The fireworks show is scheduled for the night of July 3rd. State government will hire a company to do the display and a crew to film it. Rob Wallace is an assistant secretary in the Interior Department, which oversees the Park Service. He says the show can be done responsibly.
Well, I've just seen videos of the fireworks in the past over Mount Rushmore. It's an inspirational sight. It's got to make every American proud of not only the monument, but the 4th of July celebration and who we are as a nation.
The South Dakota House of Representatives has passed a resolution inviting President Trump to the show. It remains to be seen whether he'll attend.
Every Wednesday, we bring you the Dakota Political Junkies. This week's two junkies dove into a discussion about the riot-boosting legislation we've all been hearing about and rights regarding the First Amendment more broadly. This and a couple other things, so let's take a listen.
There's a lot happening in the state capitol this week, so we've placed calls to our Dakota Political Junkies for their appraisal. John Hunter is publisher of the Madison Daily Leader, and he's joining us by phone in Madison. Good afternoon, John.
Good afternoon, Laurie.
And Jonathan Ellis is with the Sioux Falls Argus Leader. He's on the line in Sioux Falls as well. Welcome back, Jonathan.
Thank you, and I'm not going to be boosting any riots on the show today.
No boosting, please. Thank you. We're going to keep everything very civil and calm here. But it brings up this really great question as we've kind of, you know, this is in the lexicon now where we just say riot boosting. This was something that came up last year, was deemed unconstitutional. This is the second try at it. Jonathan, can you explain what this legislation is really trying to get to at its heart? What is riot boosting?
So basically, this is some preemptive legislation that that the governor sponsored last year to with the thought that someday there's going to be this Trans-Canada pipeline that's going to be built, and we'll see some protests of that. And the original legislation, you know, made it a crime for if you were inciting people to riot and there was property damage or violence, that the government could then go after you. So that passed, and of course it was controversial because it was introduced very late in the session. There was very little debate. It gets ramrodded through, and then on to inevitable court challenge. Parts of it struck down as unconstitutional, and now we have this second effort, which repeals, I think, some of the language that was struck down. And if you look at the bill as it's been amended and it passed through the House yesterday, that it tries to focus on violent acts, and so I think that the supporters of the legislation now are hopeful that it passes muster, First Amendment muster, because it focuses on, inciting violence. You have disagreement, however, from the ACLU that this is just more of an infringement upon the First Amendment. We already have existing laws in place throughout the country. And so you have, again, another deep division about what the intent here is with regard to we expect someday this pipeline to be built.
John Hunter, is inciting an act of violence already illegal? And if so, how does this bill propose to do anything different? So
I'm glad you asked the first question of Jonathan, because it is a hard one to answer. I think the original intent, and there's a myriad of different sides of this one, was to try to find someone or try to find many people to somehow take financial responsibility for whatever happens. And so they're trying to extend. So let's pretend person A comes and does substantial property damage on someone. They want to not only have that person be responsible, but for the someone else who said, hey, go set that thing on fire in protest. And so they're trying to say that, there's other people. And even if they're far away, if they encouraged or pushed people to have this property damage or violence, that they should both be responsible for that. And so, I'm a defender of the First Amendment and the freedom of Americans to protest peaceably and freedom of speech. I think I've been very strong in my defense of those. But as Jonathan said, that it's a preemptive thing. They're trying to kind of legislate something before it happens and prevent this thing. So it is very complicated. I don't know if this version still will make it through the courts. That's the intent of the sponsors, but I would guess it would be challenged again, and we'll see if it passes. I mean, it's only gone through the House. It has a ways to go.
Right, and as lawmakers and peers are talking about that this pipeline symbolizes something that's a heck of a lot more than a pipeline, including race and climate change and political party. And you can see Republicans and Democrats and peers, voting on party lines pretty strictly on this.
Absolutely, and you're right, Laurie. And there may be even some that we haven't mentioned there, but
right.
It has to do with climate change. It has to do with alternative energy. It has to do with economics, either here in the Gulf.
It has to do with Obama and Trump. Yeah, it has to do with presidential election. Yeah,
absolutely. So how do you sort those people out? Then it seems as though some people at least come into that conversation with their minds made up based on one of those other factors, regardless of what this particular thing is. It's hard to have debates and to craft legislation when people have essentially decided how they feel about an issue before it gets introduced, and based on factors that aren't going to be discussed here.
Right. And Victoria Wicks, in her reporting on this, mentioned that Speaker of the House Stephen Haugaard was a Republican who said, no, not yet. This isn't there yet. So there are outliers. I think that's important to note as well. I want to shift a little bit, but stay on the First Amendment and talk about the story that Jonathan wrote for the Argus Leader about a social media censorship bill and its a sort of quick and undignified demise. But tell us a little bit about this legislation, Jonathan, and what the debate tells us, again, about broader conversations in our society right now.
Well, sponsor, Jeff Monroe of Pure, had brought a bill that would have allowed users of social media platforms who had content censored to sue those social media companies. They had to have, I guess, 75 million users or more. So basically we're looking at the big ones like Facebook and Twitter and maybe Instagram. But yeah, the bill died quickly. There was really no debate about it at all. But it does, I think, get to the point that there are conservatives who are concerned that these giant social media platforms have been censoring speech, and that these private businesses are becoming so powerful that they're almost sort of quasi-governmental in a way in which they can control speech. So there is this. And so obviously we should know that the First Amendment only applies to the government, and I think this is an attempt by Senator Monroe to apply the First Amendment to some big social media companies that are involved in communication.
Jonathan, any thoughts about this as it ties into broader social conversations right now? People are upset and asking questions. Maybe we're thinking about the First Amendment in ways that we haven't in quite some time because of some of these challenges.
Well, yeah, and I think that that's definitely true. And like John, I'm pretty much a First Amendment absolutist. Nowadays, anybody on a social media account with a significant number of followers can kind of say whatever they want. And, that has not always been the case, obviously. There were in our industry sort of gatekeepers about what would be permitted on a letter to the editor, for example, mm-hmm. So that you wouldn't necessarily get, crazy stuff written about. I listen to some tinfoil hat legislation today. Okay, some of this stuff just comes out. So there has been definitely a change what we talk about, how we talk about it, because of social media, and then of course the concerns that these social media companies are going to subjectively decide what they consider to be hate speech, for example. If you were to go and ask somebody on the far left or far right what they consider hate speech, we would probably have different definitions of that.
Right. Tinfoil hat legislation. Nice one. John Hunter, anything you want to weigh in on social media and, really disinformation and just how this is sort of affecting our daily lives?
Yeah, I do. Thanks. I think we need to understand that there are actually some people who really oppose the First Amendment, and that seems hard to imagine.
Right.
Where you'd say we shouldn't have freedom of speech, and that's in some senses it's a growing movement. It would be startling to most Americans over the last 240 years that have counted on that and differentiated America by allowing people to speak freely, but. There are a lot of people, and again, they say you shouldn't be able to speak about this or that or so forth. And actually, there are a fair number of college students. You'd be surprised, I think, that young people are saying, no, you should censor us. You should not allow. I've heard that comment. We're on college campuses. We should not be allowed to speak freely. And I'm surprised that people want to give up that right. But clearly with the social media companies, remember, these are unmonitored, as Jonathan was requiring. If you have write a letter to the editor of a newspaper, we would exclude things that would be illegal or, include certain things, profanity and so forth, that might not be appropriate for a general audience. But these social media companies, they don't go through that process. And everyone who is criticized then thinks that the social media company should take out the criticism of that whether it's left or right or whatever that is. So, yeah, I think really freedom of speech as we know it is up for debate.
Let's talk a little bit about the state budget. And as we hit the halfway mark in the South Dakota State Legislature, it's time to really turn up the volume on that a little bit. And again, we're seeing, John Hunter, let's start with you, some real party division and people really saying it matters that the Republicans are in charge. You want more Democrats. You want fewer Democrats. It's definitely a political conversation already.
It is. There are all sorts of what I find interesting, really, Lori, is that you'll hear Cracker Barrel kind of discussions. And that's, I think, in many cases where the rubber meets the road, right? These are our people from our district or districts across the state meeting with their constituents, their neighbors, and so forth. And those are fairly common of kind of a unified message of being able to try to find money for teacher salaries and those kind of things. And you get to actual votes in the appropriation committee, and then on the floor it gets harder because then you get specific, and if you have a limited pool of money, then how do you choose between A and B? And back in the Cracker Barrel, you said, I like both A and B. But right. Then eventually when you get to peer, you sometimes have to decide. So it gets very difficult. South Dakota, in a lot of cases, has been conservative in its revenue forecasts. And then we get to this mid-session revision of that. And it often, I haven't kept track of it, but it often will show a little bit better than what we thought. So from the governor's budget address in December until mid-February, we have a chance. We usually have a little bit more money, and we're able to satisfy some of those things.
Yeah, Jonathan. When I first went to Pierre, the early talk, governor's state of the state address, the Republican leadership in the state legislature, the Democratic leadership in the state legislature, all said the same thing, and that's that we want to fund those inflationary pay increases for teachers, state employees, and service care providers. We just have to figure out how to do it. But it's money's tight. Do you think that that's still driving the ship in Pierre when it comes to appropriation?
I do. I think that is a priority for a lot of lawmakers, especially those lawmakers on appropriations. You've seen now revenue forecasts that are a little better than what were initially proposed by the governor. You know, the fight always comes down to, and it's not unusual for the legislature to want to pick a rosier revenue forecast than the governor. That's actually, that happens all the time. And so the fight will be between, I think, the governor, potentially this is where the fight will be at the end of the day on the budget, will be between the governor and maybe some lawmakers who want to go ahead and have a rosier projection than the governor's office is maybe comfortable with. You know, in terms of the politics of it, of course, this is the politics. I mean, I think the complaints that you see from some Democrats, I think they've probably complained about education funding in every legislature since 1890. So this is nothing new. They've asked, they complain that Republicans are a little too parsimonious with the budget, and they've put forward proposals. And they do this frequently to maybe use some one-time funding from like state trust funds to prop up some spending. That's a fairly common. That's something that they propose. I want to say almost every year to get into trust funds. They think that the state has held on to those too closely. So, these are, and you will take them these ideas to the voters in this upcoming election. And they've done this every year I've ever covered the legislature.
And to be fair, we say they've complained about education, and they would say we've advocated for education every year, and people should pay attention to that. Why is it up to us? And if that's the only group that's going to do it, I mean, Jamie Smith was talking largely about that in some of his press conferences of being pretty vocal about their advocacy for education and using it as an opportunity to say, pay attention who you vote for. I want to talk about, John Hunter, your editorial in the Madison Daily Leader about buffer strips. And I think everybody knows what a buffer strip is, but tell us a little bit about how they're impacting our lives now, especially as we head into spring flooding season, and why you chose this as a topic to bring attention to right now?
Well, there's there's a couple different things why it's timely now. One, as you're aware, these buffer strips are intended to be next to creeks and streams and lakes and so on to somehow grab excess nutrients and sediment from fields and cities and so forth. So the idea is you'd plant grasses along each side of a creek, and then as the rain comes and the snow melts, then whatever excess nitrogen and phosphorus are then used by these grasses, they don't make it into the waterways, which then would help reduce algae blooms and so forth. But sediment is also a part of that, too. So erosion, you think of farm field erosion or city erosion, and these, again, these grassy strips, and they can vary in width, how far away from the water you get. But they capture sediment as well, and sediment is getting to be a bigger problem in South Dakota lakes and streams than it has been, and part of that is the increased flow in a lot of rivers and streams, primarily due to tiling, so that the rivers, which in a lot of cases, here we are in February of 2020, are full and running and have a lot of sediment in those. As sediment builds up in lakes and streams, or mostly in creeks and streams, then it reduces the capacity. So as water comes through during a heavy rain event or something, it's more likely to flood. Now in Madison, we're scrambling right now in preparation for melting in a few weeks to clean out these creeks of sediment so that the creeks can handle the capacity that needs to and doesn't flood and destroy people's homes and so on. So South Dakota a few years ago put in a voluntary buffer strip legislation that gives a small property tax break for those people who do that. Not many people have applied for that. Now, there may be some people who are planting grassy strips without, or buffer strips without applying to the program for the discount on property taxes. Our neighbor in Minnesota has made it mandatory, which certainly is not kind of South Dakota style to make that kind of stuff mandatory. But they've had preliminary compliance of very strong there, even though not, people don't always agree with it. So I'm thinking that in South Dakota, we may not want to go to the mandatory level, but I think we should increase our incentives to try to plant these, get the economic development, the economic benefits and the ecological benefits of these grassy strips for not a lot of extra money. I think it'd be prudent for us to do that.
You say 99% of land, the compliance in Minnesota, 99% adjacent to lakes and streams, and 95% of all bodies of water in South Dakota, it's more like 40%.
Right.
Reported 40%, yeah.
Yeah, that's a big deal. It really does matter. I don't think there's any dispute about the science of buffer strips.
Right. So why not make it mandatory then?
Well, because not everyone believes South Dakota, which, as you may know, is very strong on individual property ownership rights. Like, if I have this land, I should be able to do with it.
Right. It will die a swift death in the legislature, like the social media bill did. Is that what you're saying?
Go ahead, Jonathan.
Yeah. I was going to say, Lori, if you still have a second, I don't want to run out of time, but this is a great, very interesting topic, and John is right. I would say that if there's not a solution found, if they don't come up with a solution, okay, if this voluntary program isn't working, as John says that in his editorial, that we need to find more, boost the incentive for this to work. Here's what's going to happen. It's a problem. Water quality is a problem, okay? And if it isn't dealt with here, by our legislature, I can tell you that eventually it's going to be dealt with on a national level, okay? And you already have national environmental groups who are wanting federal legislation. So it's in landowners' best interest now to deal with this now, or else it's probably the regulation is just going to get worse.
Yeah, and to do that, you might need that incentive. Or that might be one way to think about, use the incentive, everybody rally behind the incentive, let's go solve the problem, because the problem needs to be solved.
It is a growing problem.
Yeah.
And you think of Minnesota, remember that with the land of 10,000 lakes or whatever, that they believe...
or whatever.
Or, yeah, they'll say 15,000.
It's like a super South Dakota thing to say.
Every puddle.
Go ahead.
I think generally have been more protective of those lakes. I mean, because I think it's been a bigger part of who they are. And, and so the lakes in the glacial lakes region have a lot of nitrogen and phosphorus in them, a lot of algae blooms. And is that something we want to fix, or is that something we want to continue or get worse? Those are decisions for both voters and legislators.
Fascinating stuff. John Hunter, Jonathan Ellis, thank you so much for being here. We appreciate your time.
Thanks, Lori.
Thank you.
If you've been paying attention to local politics, you've heard the news that House Bill 1057 failed in the state Senate Health and Human Services Committee. So why is it still making news today? Well, to answer that question, we had Ellie Krug, a transgender woman and a national speaker on human inclusivity, on the program. And here she is answering that very question.
So, you know, I'm 63 years old. I have 6 decades of perspective and grit building. For our 14-year-old or 15-year-old or 12-year-old transgender child or teen, they don't have that perspective or grit. And when you hear year in and year out, you laid that out at the beginning of the program, you know, that people in your state want you not to be present in public, because that's what the bathroom bill is about. If you cannot use a public bathroom, you cannot leave your house. If you can't use the bathroom or the locker room at school, you may not be able to go to school. And so then you're no longer present in public. And so our younger people, they hear that message, and it's devastating to them, because they're already struggling with this societal view that your, you know, brain and body have to match. And then now they get the message from the government that you are unworthy. And I don't want to sound overly dramatic here to you, but that is the message that they are receiving.
Governor Kristi Noem backs a legislative proposal that could change the state's local zoning and appeals process. Noem says it will streamline development in rural South Dakota, especially for wind farms and livestock operations. That could affect Yankton County, where a number of large-scale livestock farms have gone up. Residents are split over the future of that kind of agricultural development. SDPB's Lee Strubinger takes us to Yankton County.
Carl Shank walks through his newest building, a hog barn with 2,400 animals. The steady hum of the temperature control system keeps the inside temperature at 65 degrees even on a cold winter afternoon. The system even adds humidity to the air. White pipes that look like PVC stretch the length of the hog barn. They distribute feed to about 60 pens organized into 2 rows.
But they have feed 24 hours a day. They're never without feed. Everything is monitored. If the feed starts to get low, we're notified through our cell phones. We know the weight in the bins. At any time, we can dial it up and see how much feed is on premise.
Light from industrial-strength bulbs reflect off a lagoon below. The hog waste drains through slits in the floor.
We keep about 35 pigs to a pen. As they grow and get larger, we'll grow into the empty pens you see here. So they're never overly dense. If you get overly dense, they're not comfortable. If they're not comfortable, they're not gaining weight.
Dozens of pigs stumble out of our way as we walk through the building.
All these pigs are weighing about 55 pounds on average when they come in. As you can tell, they're clean, they're curious, they're happy pigs. If they were outside today where it's 9 degrees, everything they would be eating would be just to maintain their body condition and to stay warm.
Shank's been raising hogs like this for almost 3 years, and he wishes he had made the change earlier. But the future of this kind of agricultural development has raised new questions in Yankton County. Since June of 2017, the county has approved 20 large-scale livestock operations. That's the year Shank and 3 other farmers decided to expand. Shank says they needed a critical mass of animals to get feed resources in Yankton County.
We all came forward at the same time, which in hindsight may have been a mistake. Maybe we should have done it individually. But being good friends, and we thought it'd be wise to go into this together and see what happened. Because we needed to have some economies of scale with these barns.
A concentration of hog farms brings in contract opportunities with large companies. Shank now works with Canadian-based Sunterra Farms.
They are experts at what they do. So we have refined this business just like every other business in America, be it Amazon or Walmart. They have found a very good formula, a very good model to make this work.
That picturesque view we all have from the past of the farm, that's going. And it's because of this integrated model.
That's Emily Raddick, a member of the group Quality of Life for South Dakota. It tracks the development of large livestock operations. Raddick worries about the health and safety of nearby residents, the environmental consequences, and declining property values that can come with concentrated animal feeding operations, also called CAFOs.
It's a shame. It's a crying shame. And it's sad. And like I said, it's everyday life for us, because those of us that are advocating, and we're not advocating against all CAFOs. That's not what it is. That's not it at all.
Raddick lives about 2 miles away from the site of another proposed large-scale hog operation. The local citizens group wants permits to include details designed to reduce the smell and increase distance from neighbors.
If they're sited correctly away from water and away from neighbors, we have no problem with it. The only time we have a problem is when there's three or four neighbors calling us saying, please help us.
A bill the governor supports would shorten the zoning and appeal process at the county level. And neighbors who file a suit against a farmer would have to pay court costs and damages if the farmer wins in court. Zane Williams sits on the Yankton County Planning and Zoning Commission. He says the bill could be good for South Dakota.
They might have some remorse. They might have to pay for the other person's, legal bills. And otherwise, it's just a stamp and say, I don't like this. And I think those days are going to go by.
Williams is also chair of the Marindal Township Board. It's one of 5 townships that might withdraw from Yankton County. He says part of the reason is the county's heavy-handed approach to large-scale animal feedlot operations. The bill simplifies county approval for large projects. It would require a simple majority vote. That concerns Sherry Lost, chair of the Yankton County Commission, which requires a 4/5 approval. She says that decision is best left to counties.
But when you get up to the conditional use level, that should be left at the county's discretion. So the word shall shouldn't be there. It should be the choice of the county for a conditional use permit approval.
She's one of 3 commissioners voted into office 2 years ago because of concern about large hog farms. Now, Lost is helping to rework the county's zoning ordinance.
It is not realistic to say we will never allow a confined animal feeding operation in Yankton County. That it is just not realistic. So everybody needs to come together and to say, well, this is a good path forward. And like I said, nobody's going to walk away winning the jackpot. We're all going to have a skinned knee at the end of the day.
A Senate Committee on State Affairs is passing the bill along to the Senate floor. It still has to make its way through the House. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Lee Strupinger in Pierre.
On February 25th, the voters of Rapid City have a big decision to make. It's a $190 million bond proposal that plans for 3 new elementary schools and large-scale facility improvements throughout the district. If voters approve the measure, and they need 60% of voters to say yes to approve it, property owners will see a tax increase of 85 cents for every $1,000 valuation. And that means if you have a home worth $100,000, your taxes will increase about $7 per month. A $250,000 home will see an increase of about $17 per month. The debate over the school bond issue has become intense. And on Thursday, we talked about how a community envisions its future, balancing growth, and innovation with fiscal responsibility and accountability. Tom Johnson, the CEO, president of Elevate Rapid City, sat down with Lori to give his perspective on the bond issue. Let's take a listen.
Tom, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Lori. Good morning. I'm happy to be here. This is great. Thank you.
Tell us, especially for people who are listening across the state, why is this so contentious of an issue in Rapid City right now? Because that really gets at where Rapid City is at in this particular time in history, doesn't it?
Yeah, Lori, it really does. I came here about 4 months ago. I'm originally from the Front Range. And so when I got here, it was interesting to see the different sides and where they staked out. I think really why it's so contentious is you have, a group of folks, and in South Dakota, we like to think of ourselves as very conservative. So anything resembling any kind of a tax hike, whether it's 1 cent or $10, just philosophically, we generally, as people here, are kind of opposed to taxes increasing in any way, shape, or form. At the same time, we're in a place in Rapid City and South Dakota's history where we're going to see growth, and we want companies to come and young professionals, and we want to see the kind of prosperity that we see, in some of our neighboring states with technology jobs. And so in order to bring some of those, we have to focus on what attracts workforce, and what attracts workforce often for young professionals is the quality of the schools. And so you see these tensions sort of play out in real time because of those two competing sort of viewpoints.
Yeah, you have written in the Rapid City Journal that people should vote yes for this. So this is something that you believe is important to go forward. How come?
I did. And for me, it's just out of the fact that my job is to try to help the Rapid City economy prosper. Elevate Rapid City's mission, in fact, is to elevate the Rapid City region for everyone. That includes Native American workforce and everybody. And so when you look at that and when you talk to companies, and I've talked in my short time here to probably four or five companies that are actively looking at Rapid City from outside of the region, and we're talking large companies, often the first thing they say to me is, can we get the workforce here? And when I make the case for that workforce that yes, we can, they quickly pivot to, okay, what are the quality of the schools, not just in terms of the scores, but am I going to have the kind of facilities that my kids are going to want to be here? And so when you hear from actual companies that the quality of the facilities of the schools matter so much, you begin to realize that passing this bond is paramount and critical to our future. And so if we want to be the kind of community and state that we are hoping to be, which attracts workers, we have to focus on this issue.
What's the competition? What is it like in other communities? I mean, we're broadcasting from, I'm sitting in Sioux Falls in the SDPB Sioux Falls district. I have a little context for what schools are like here in Sioux Falls, but your experience is broader. Tell me a little bit about how companies make that decision and who the competition is. What kind of choices are they making?
Lori, the competition, I'm not going to lie, is fierce. I mean, there is, everybody around us is focusing on the quality of their education and including facilities. So obviously you're in Sioux Falls, so you know that Sioux Falls passed a bond improving the quality of their schools. But if you look north in Bismarck, if you look west towards Gillette, if you look southwest towards Denver in the Front Range, and even in Nebraska, if you look at Lincoln and Omaha, Minneapolis, you just see all around us, everyone is focusing on education and how important it is. And many, many of them have passed bonds like this to improve the facilities and the condition of their schools. And so the competition is fierce. I don't want to see Rapid City left behind. And further, it really does scare me a bit that we can't recruit the kinds of doctors and physicians and professionals to the community. And so I often hear from seniors on this topic that they don't want to see their property taxes go up by, $50 or $100 a year. And I say, well, I think the trade-offs can be challenging. If we can't get the kind of doctors that you need, the specialists that we need in Rapid City, we're going to have a hard time attracting talent. And I think seniors are going to actually have to drive to some of these more prosperous communities and get health care if we don't have these specialists. And we can't get these specialists unless they like the quality of life in Rapid City. And the only way they're going to like the quality of life in Rapid City is to match our world-class outdoor recreation, our world-class higher educational facilities, with frankly world-class K-12 facilities. So it's just absolutely critical we do this.
Talk a little bit about the real estate market, if you will. There are many people who maybe don't, and one of the challenges with the school bond vote is always there are so many people who don't have children who maybe stay home that day. And they think about what happens to their taxes. What happens to your property value when there's, even if you don't have children?
Well, what I like to think of is the future a little bit. And you can imagine a scenario, and Rapid City is growing. And so what's happening is if we can pass this school bond, we will be able to attract more people here. We will be able to attract more companies here. And so what will happen is there will be a larger base of people and companies from which we can draw that tax base. So ultimately, at the end of the day, your taxes won't increase as much because you have a broader base from which to draw those taxes from. And so it's actually quite the opposite. The more prosperity we have as a result of passing this school bond, the larger our tax base is going to be from which we can draw. And therefore, in the future, the taxes won't need to go up. We won't have to raise property taxes in the future because of that. So I see just the opposite. Prosperity allows us a larger, broader, more diverse base of people and properties to draw from. But I certainly respect and understand those folks who aren't fixed incomes and why they might be worried that their taxes could go up. I think, to the contrary, it'll allow us to broaden our base. And I think those fears are probably unfounded, but I certainly respect and understand that perspective.
One of the reasons we asked you is not only the role that you have in Rapid City now with Elevate Rapid City, but the fact that you are new to the community. And so you are kind of looking at some of the debate with fresh eyes as well. Tell me a little bit about what you've learned about this city through letters to the editor and the questions people are asking you and how they've sort of responded to this really big challenge, really on the heels of another really big challenge, which was the Burnett Arena.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I have come from other places and seen what they've done. I'd say the level of intensity in Western South Dakota around how we decide collectively how to fund education and what kind of community we want to be is definitely more intense. I was not quite prepared for the level of intensity of how people express themselves on this issue. I think there's generally a little bit more civil discourse than other places I've been, but that's okay. You know, our goal is to try to elevate the whole region, and we understand the opposition's perspective. And, you know, we just, I think, have to continue to make the argument about how this can affect our future. We know that Rapid City is a world-class community with one of the best institutions in the country, South Dakota School of Mines and Technology. In fact, we have an educational hub with Black Hills State, Oglala Lakota College, Western Dakota Tech. We've got world-class mountain biking, an amazing downtown that we put money in. The hospital's invested $250 million into itself. The arena is $130 million. The base is coming. That's likely $1 billion or more investment and potentially 1,000 or more jobs. We see all these investments Rapid City is making in itself. What we can't do is go backwards on K-12. So while we're trying to be world-class and we're attracting workers from the Front Range in Minneapolis and other areas, what we can't do is go backwards and ensure that our facilities of our K-12 system are third class. We have to have first-class facilities just like we do in other areas.
And for folks who are coming off of the Barnett Arena conversation and are feeling, you know, overwhelmed by the pace of this change, speak to them a little bit, because it can feel like a lot of this is coming rather quickly.
Yeah, it is a little bit. If you've been here, and of course I'm new to this, so I wasn't here for the arena, so it doesn't seem fast to me, of course. But if you've been here, I can imagine that's fast. What I would say is, change is coming in Western South Dakota. It's coming in Sioux Falls. It's coming in a lot of areas of the state. As citizens in the area and the community, we can either decide how we want that change to look and how we want to affect that change and keep the quality of life that we enjoy here in the Black Hills and what we have. We can shape that future. Or we can do things like not pass this bond and let the future be shaped by somewhere else, by forces outside, and just watch as that change happens to us. So really, it's a matter of being proactive or reactive. And I prefer, frankly, for us to be proactive.
Now, if you want to hear more on this issue, check out listen.sdpb.org, and you can hear both sides of the argument. That's those who want to see you vote yes and those who want to see you vote no. That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. If you're looking for an individual segment from our radio program, you can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org or by following the In the Moment Segments podcast. And if you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh, Steve Zwemke, and Chris Loffrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Thanks for listening.